And on ABC Radio and on your pod, you're with me, Noel Debien, on The Good Life. Somalia has been back in the news today with more relief being able to get through into Mogadishu during this time of Ramadan, the fasting month for the world's Muslims. Muslim teachers regard it as a time for inner reflection, for purification, for the giving of charity and for self-discipline. But it also means no food between sunrise and sunset. It also happens that this fasting month of Ramadan coincides with the most severe famine on the Horn of Africa in living memory. That's that corner up near Saudi Arabia. Millions of lives are at risk, and Somalia is perhaps one Muslim-majority nation where practical help is just not simple to provide, because political instability and lawlessness makes the work of donor nations very difficult to get stuff through. Well, The Good Life this week visited a family of Australian Somali expats. That was to find out a little more about Somali customs and the Somali people. Now, the father of this family is actually the son of a former Somali nomad, and Mohammed came here to Australia as a refugee. He's made a new life here with his family, so much so that his kids are all in private school, and therein lies a happy migrant tale. Because Ramadan means that all healthy and observant Muslims are fasting, at the time the sun sets, the Maghrib, family and friends gather to break their fast at what's called the iftar meal. That's if they have any food to eat.
Why tonight? Now you eat the rest of the stuff. My name is Mohammed Ibrahim. I'm the father of this family of seven. We live in southwest Sydney, and today is the fourth day of Ramadan, and we're just about to have our iftar.
My name is Muna, and I live in Brisbane. I go to school.
Hello, my name is Ilyas, and I am a student at Seoul College, and I've been fasting so far for all of Ramadan.
My name is Aisha, and I go to Seoul College, and I am the second youngest of this family.
My name is Mustafa. I go to Seoul College. I've been fasting for 4 days already in Ramadan.
I see the dates. I've been to Uyghur families, who are Chinese Muslims, yep. Lebanese families, yep. Turkish families, and I always see the date.
Yeah, date is very, very significant for breaking iftar. It's a sunnah, which is the tradition of our Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So normally that you break your fast with dates and water. So that's quite standard for any culture to have those two elements in there.
But I see also things that I had to research and find out. There are various dishes here which are quite traditionally Somali, aren't they?
Typically, I think what we've got here is more or less 70 to 80% the typical Somali iftar. After the dates, you normally have what we call bajio, which is made of peas. And you
that's
got...
this one. That's right.
This one here.
Yeah. And then you got sambusa there. And also in the middle there, you got the bur.
Now, these ones are savory, I think, are they? Is that right?
The bajia is a little bit salty. And what normally people do that, they can eat with a lemon if they want to. Otherwise, you can eat as it is. But the sambusa, you can have a variety of things inside there, the fillings. For this one, the filling is a mincemeat mixed with the green peas and carrots, crushed carrots, and etc. So it's quite got a lot of spices in there.
This one here is a very traditional Somali bread too, isn't it?
Yeah, that's something that you won't find anywhere in other cultures. That's called injera. It's got a bit of Indian influence and Arab influence there. And injera, again, is a very typical Somali dish. Normally you eat with this dish here, which is a diced meat. We call it sugar. So these two are very popular in Somali culture, sugar and anjero.
Now, if I asked you, which one's your favourite, Mona?
Bajia.
This is the pea one, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'll go for the sugar over there.
The stew, isn't it?
Yeah.
I like the...
what?
These ones. This
one? Oh, what do they taste like?
They taste like the butter with... honey.
Oh, yum, honey. That'd be delicious.
Why tonight? No, you eat the rest of the stuff.
Give me
this. No, you had enough in us. Yes. Eat the other stuff. What do you want?
This one looks like a flask of some sort, is it?
Yeah, it's a flask. It's a hot for hot drinks, and it got what's called gahwa. It's a traditional Somali coffee. It tastes totally different than the processed coffees. So why is it a small flask? It's only for me, not for kids.
Oh, this is the father of the house's drink.
Right. This is their specialty.
Ooh, that's very distinctive. There's cardamom or something?
Yeah, it's got a cardamom and also got a ginger and other spice as well.
Mohammed Ibrahim, we read a lot about Somalia in the papers, as if there'll never be a solution to the problem, if you know what I mean. There always seems to be something terrible happening. But I just watched your family at prayer breaking the fast at iftar. How helpful has Islam been to Somalis in trying to make sense of and respond to the difficulties that Somalis are facing in Somalia itself?
Islam is a unifying factor. The reason for that is at the moment we had iftar here, but our mind is with those people who are currently fasting. At the same time, they don't have even iftar to break their fast. So for us, our mind and heart are with those people. Somalia is a very, very unfortunate country. The people of Somalia are currently suffering a drought that is the worst for 60 years. And the political upheaval and the civil war and the lack of functioning government is contributing all the misery of the innocent Somalis, regardless what tribe they are from, regardless what political affiliation they have. So for us, Islam is the hope for the Somalis.
It also means something practical, I know, because in your organization, the Somali community here, which you're a leader of, have been making practical arrangements to assist with money, haven't they?
That's true. We can't sit here and enjoy the good life we got here. We are human beings to start with. And as a fellow Somalis, we ought to help them. So the Somali community in New South Wales came together and started doing fundraising a few weeks back. And thanks to God, we have been very successful. To date, we have sent over $100,000 to those who are most in need, especially those who can't even travel to refugee camps. To go to refugee camp, you need $30 to do that. There are some families who can't afford to do that. Elderly person, young kids, they can't make those kind of journeys. So our support was to help those people who haven't able to make that journey yet and they haven't reached the refugee camps.
There'll be people who look at Somalia and they see this problem that's come up again. There's a drought. Millions of people are in dire need. There'll be people saying, this is not just about hungry people. This is about a state that's not working. Is there any real hope for the future while the state itself in Somalia is in such disarray?
Oh, that's a million-dollar question. It has to be a compromise solution, and that compromise solution must come from the Somalis, and the diaspora must play their role as well there, because if every educated person tries to distance themselves from the problem, then no one will help us. If we sit down and say, okay, there's international community there, there are NGOs there, they can fix the problem in Somalia, yes, they may be able to help to some extent, but I think if we just do the right thing and just put aside our differences. But to answer your question, I don't have a straight answer when the Somali situation will be overcome, but I think at the moment the priority is to feed those people who are starving to death, and we have to do at most how we could do it.
There are those who are afraid that donor money or support money is not going to go into the right places, that it could be siphoned off or actually not get there. How have you gone about transferring or making sure that the money that you've worked hard to earn actually gets spent where it belongs?
We created Somali Drought Relief. It's an NGO, charity organization. It got the authority for fundraising, and the money we collected is all deposited into an account, and no money is kept by individuals. So that when we send money, it has to be in line with the surrounding government laws And also it must be sent to those who are intended for and to reach them in a short period of time without deducting any overhead costs. So what we did was we had local NGOs who were working with the Somali community on the ground for the last 20 years. So we channeled the money through them directly, and there's no single cent deducted from there. It's all volunteer-based. 100% whatsoever is donated goes to the right people. And our efforts are directed to where the aid is not reaching at this stage, as Kevin Wright has pointed out when he visited Dolo the other day. And that's where our effort is directed to.
So that being said, that you're arranging to get it through to the places where it's most needed, the idea of clan is actually quite important to the Somali and understanding who the Somalis are, isn't it? In a good sense, I mean, not only a bad sense.
It's true. The clans is a fabric of the Somali community. No one can ignore that. Clan always plays part of the equation. Sometimes clans can be a very, very positive thing. Like, for example, dealing with a domestic dispute, for example. The clan is sometimes very effective in those kind of customary laws. But also, on the political front, the clans are used to share power. Clans become significant when it comes to political process or their situation on the customary laws.
That's the thing that I think I find most interesting, this idea of customary law among the Somalis, which struck me when I first came across it. There's even a special name for it, isn't there?
Yeah, it's called her. Her means just a law. It's their direct translation.
And that her, or that law, is actually a way elders within the community can step into disputes sometimes and negotiate and actually assist families or people with problems into sorting them out without needing to turn to police or courts.
Yeah, it's practice everywhere. It's practice here in Australia. It's practice in Somalia. It's practice everywhere Somalis are. So just to give an example, if there's a, say, domestic dispute within a Somali family, the first contact point is not the police straight away. They normally go to their elders and they will complain if there's any issue there, and then they will step in and they try to reconcile the family if there's no really criminal offense there, and they will try to make sure that the families get united. But of course, they will do everything they do within the Australian laws. And also, if they came across someone who was really destitute and he or she doesn't have any means of survival here or anywhere, and then the elders, they can come together and they say, okay, now, based on our customary laws, we need to collect money for this person. They would nominate amount for each clan to collect it. So then to support the family who was in a crisis situation. So there are many aspects that you could use the laws here.
I was also struck that things like dowry, arrangement of marriage, all these things, the family, it seems to me, is really fundamental to understanding who Somalis are. The family seems right at the basis of how you identify who you are and how you behave socially.
It is right that the social aspect, the social laws we're just talking now, it touches every aspect of the one's life. As you rightly pointed out, even when you're arranging marriage, yes, you may have a girlfriend or boyfriend and then you may decide to marry each other. But again, once you make that decision, there's a ways to go about that. You have to inform the parents and then you have to invite the elders and then they will decide in terms of what will be the process forward. Normally, the bride or the bridegroom will get advice from the elders to make things happen.
How unusual or usual is arranged marriage, where families actually talk and say, we think my son and your daughter, how often would that actually happen?
It's not the way it used to be. In the past, arranged marriage was quite norm within the Somali community, but increasingly it's not popular anymore. But the parents can encourage their daughters and sons to certain person. But that's only encouragement rather than now making arrangement, because in the current environment, whether it's in Somalia or here in Australia, arranged marriage is not the way it used to be.
So it would be fair enough for me to think that in, say, 15 years' time, you won't be as a father planning a husband for Aisha Ramona, for example, your two young daughters.
My role is to guide them. They have to make their decision for their life, but I'm here to guide them through the right place, yeah.
Allahu Akbar. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Malik Yawm al-Din. إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم لإله قريش.
I watched how you prayed with your children, and you've clearly shown them how to pray. And I watched here also at iftar how Islam is part of the way this family functions. It's very important that they've learnt their religious traditions, and you personally take interest in that as their father. How important is that idea of Islam and the way Islam helps you to shape your life or regulate your life compared to, say, the customary laws of the Somali? How do those two things relate? Which one trumps what?
I think one thing has to be very, very clear. Islam is a way of life. Every culture comes second. So Islam is the supreme religion. It is the religion we practice. It's the way of life. But when it comes to practicing, then every culture is different. The Indonesian culture is different than Somali culture, than Turkish culture, so then the Arabic culture. So the cultures are different, the way people practice certain things. But customary laws we talked earlier, they take their reference from Islam, so they are not above Islam.
I also noticed as we were having dinner and as the iftar was happening, there was some discussion of Somalia. And it seems to me that you also, as a father, have tried to make sure your kids understand how things are in Somalia. And I believe you even have family still there.
Yeah, I still have my father over there and a couple of sisters, which I support. We have a very close link with those people in Somalia. We share their suffering here. And my kids, yes, they are also familiar with what's going on in Somalia. And it's a way of them getting a different perspective of life. So they are quite fortunate to be here in Australia. They got good education, good life. But at the same time, they need also to understand that there are some people who are related to them who are not that fortunate enough.
I can see being here in your home, it's a beautiful home, and the kids, lovely, well-behaved kids. And I know that you're very successful in business too. But you told me you were actually the son of a nomad yourself.
Yeah, my father came to the town when there was cholera. It's a quite widespread disease, and most of his family died at that time. He was a nomad, yeah, but he decided to come to the town at the time, and he ended up becoming a public servant. Before the Somali got the independence, he managed to make us what we are today. And alhamdulillah, beside God, I think we owe him for that.
Have your kids had the chance to meet him?
Unfortunately, not yet. Because of the situation in Somalia and the visa restriction in Australia, I wasn't able to link them. But inshallah, one day I'll make that to happen.
And you yourself came here as a refugee. What was the process for you of coming to become an Australian?
Yeah, when the civil war broke out in Somalia, there's no way to go. So I was lucky enough to have family friends here in Australia who were kind enough to sponsor me to come here. So that's how I end up coming here. I haven't gone through refugee camp.
You say your father is there and you've got sisters there too. How reasonable is it to want to sponsor them to bring them here, for example? Is that an easy thing to do?
No, it's not an easy thing to do. Even one of my sisters currently is living in the refugee camp in Dadaab, and Dadaab is now the worst refugee camp in the world. It houses 400,000 people, and I visited them in 2009, and for over 10 years I was trying to bring them here, but the system is quite difficult here. Although I have everything that I could support them here, it's almost impossible to bring family members to Australia.
All that being said, you took your kids to Kenya last year, didn't you?
Yeah.
I was quite struck here at dinner that these kids seem aware, and both you and I know, having seen Kenya, how shocking those camps are, how shocking the slums can be. Your kids actually have been confronted with that. They've seen just how bad it really is in the camps like the one your sister's in.
There's so many incidents and things that we could talk about how confronting was for them. Even for my wife, we haven't been there for many, many years. Just to start with, here that every toilet, you got a running water, you got a toilet paper, and you got a hand washing. over there, they just, it's not there. And my kids refuse to go to toilet because just the way they are. So, and that's just a starting point. And then, but they are forced to go there and they have to use a bucket of water to wash after themselves and stuff like that. So that's how basic it is. And sometimes you don't have lights and then you have to use candles. And they never use it there. So, it's, yes, Nairobi is a big city, but still sometimes there was a power outages. Everything they took for granted here is not there.
You're busy in business. You've got a big family, and you're very connected to your kids and very involved in their upbringing. But you also managed to be quite active in the Somali community here. What drives you to be part of the Association for Somalis here in Australia?
My kids are all born here in Australia. They're growing up. We chose to come to this country. It's a good country. We are part of the Australian society. We have to integrate and we have to be part of the Australian mainstream. So our community or the organization we set up is to do just basically that, to help the Somali community integrate more with the wider Australian. At the same time, is to help our young kids and give them balanced life and guide them through the difficult time they may have it through identity issues in terms of whether they belong Somali, Australian kind of thing. If I look back how I grew up and how my kids are growing, it's totally different. Kids here, they're lucky. They got a lot of opportunities. They can make a lot of choices in life. But the way I grew up, I don't have an opportunity. I don't have a chance. I don't have options. And there was no universities. There's no jobs in Australia, in Somalia before the civil war. So everything is just you have to support yourself. There's no welfare system. There's no businesses you could do it. So everything's limited. My kids are different here. They got a system here that can support them. They got a family here that can support them. We got a parent here, the sisters and brothers and everything else. And so their outlook will be different.
Now, if somebody's listening right now and they want to actually make a contribution because they've listened to you and they'd like to do something, what do they do?
Anyone who wants to donate any money towards the Somali drought, we have a Somali drought relief appeal, and they can donate either cash money or by check, or even they can sponsor families. Donating cash money, they can deposit on Somali drought relief accounts. BSB 062234, account number 10408824, or they can make a check payable to Somali Drought Relief and send the check to PO Box 804, Lakemba 2195.
I'll make sure all that information is connected up to our website as well so people can surf in onto the ABC site. Mohammed Ibrahim, thank you very much for your time and for introducing me to your family and to some of your customs. It's good to have you on The Good Life.
Thank you, Noel, for the opportunity.